Well, I'm very pleased to be joined today by Mark Friedman, the founder and CEO of Encore.org. Encore.org focuses on second act careers for the greater good. Mark, thank you for joining me today.
Good morning, Andrew. Thanks so much for having me on the podcast.
My pleasure. I enjoy enormously your writing and hearing you talk. And of course, you've been one of the pioneers in this area of thinking about how people engage productively and fruitfully throughout their career. Perhaps you can just say a little bit about yourself and also about Encore.org, Mark.
Sure, I'd be glad to. I've been doing this work for three decades, since I was young myself, in my late 20s, and now I'm shocked to look in the mirror and discover that I'm somebody who's about to turn 60. And actually, when I started out, I had no intention of working on longevity or aging or older people, any of those issues. I was focused on the plight of young people growing up in poverty and looking for solutions for how we could best help these children succeed against the odds. And one of the most profound lessons that I kept encountering was the importance of love, of care, of the presence of particularly caring adults to support these young people. It was a powerful finding among resilient kids who'd grown up in poverty but managed to succeed anyway. It seemed invariably there were one or more caring adults in their lives. And then efforts to engineer those kinds of relationships, even 100-year-old programs like Big Brothers Big Sisters, were shown to be hugely successful. The less uplifting aspect was that they all had vast waiting lists because they were trying to recruit people in their 20s or 30s and 40s who barely had enough time to spend with their own children, much less somebody else's. And it raised a fundamental question. If these kinds of bonds, if human connections and caring matter so much, where are the human beings to do those things that only people can do? And even then, three decades ago, before the longevity revolution and these demographic changes had fully hit home, it became clear that just from a perspective of time available, of population numbers, that the older segment of our society was particularly promising to be tapped for these kinds of roles. And so I set out along with Dr. Linda Fried, then of Johns Hopkins University, now the dean of the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia, to create a vehicle to bring older people who cared together with young people who were facing social isolation and disconnection. The program was called Experience Corps, and the name came from the third partner in the program, a great social innovator here in the United States named John Gardner. He was the American equivalent of Michael Young in the UK, and John had come up with a original idea for Experience Corps. Linda and I came together to implement it, and now it's in two dozen cities around the country and part of AARP.
Fantastic. And what do you find attracts people into this space? I mean, over the times, have you seen a change in who gets drawn into this area?
I think there's been a tremendous growth of interest in purpose in later life. You know, I think when at the time that I started working on projects like Experience Corps, retirement and leisure were the prevailing ideals in American life. But as we've been lurching forward towards 100-year-like lives, that this period of time has grown and grown. I remember in the 1940s in America, Walter Reuther, one of the great labor leaders, ran the Auto Workers Union, described retirees as too old to work, too young to die. And there was this brief hiatus between the end of work and the end of life, and that got filled with leisure. But as that gap between the 50s and 60s and anything resembling old age has grown, it's raised a whole set of questions for people about why get up in the morning, what happiness entails. And I think that's driven more and more people to look for second acts that are at the intersection of passion and purpose and oftentimes a paycheck to sustain themselves psychologically, financially, even spiritually during this extended period after their midlife careers. And so, you know, when we poll people about that, we found that already about 4 million Americans have moved into these kinds of second acts. There are plenty of famous ones, Bill Gates, Bill Clinton, but below the radar are millions of others who, one way or another, are moving into this period. And then a much larger group, over 20 million, who say it's a top priority to have a second act that's not only personally meaningful, but that means something beyond themselves. So I think the drive is in some ways much more than keeping busy or even staying connected, but it goes to questions of one's purpose in this period that used to be the leftover years, but now is increasingly becoming an opportunity for people to do some of their most important work.
And the fascinating thing about Encore, of course, is the intergenerational aspect, not just the sense of social purpose. And you said earlier that, you know, initially with the experience, the initial programs were about people in their 20s and 30s matching with the younger generation. But these are now quite big age gaps and very different generations. What does the mix bring about? What are the advantages it brings to each group?
You know, it's interesting because we've worked so hard over the last half century in this country, essentially to rebrand later life as a second youth. We've sent people off to age segregated playgrounds to while away the hours, playing golf and shuffleboard and games, and in fact, to try to create an illusion of later life as a, you know, maybe an ersatz version of a second adolescence. And the sad underbelly of that is that so much of that illusion has been predicated on keeping children out. One of the biggest retirement communities in America, Sun City, which is outside of Phoenix, actually has voluntary age police whose sole role is ferret out that human contraband, because if everybody's old, nobody's old. But that, I think an increasing accumulation of research has shown, really runs against the grain of human nature. The biggest, longest standing study of adult development in America, the Harvard study of adult development, which has been going on for 75 years, has found that older people who engage with the next generation are three times as likely to be happy as those who fail to do so. And George Vallant, one of the leaders of that study, says it's not just accident or surface concerns. It goes to the root of human nature as we get older and come closer to our own mortality. He says biology flows downhill, and that there's just a natural impulse as we get older to connect with young people. And at the same time, young people are in desperate need, as I was saying earlier, for connections themselves. And we're starting to see this happened in American society despite many barriers that have been erected over time. So we're right now, there's the highest proportion of older and younger people living together in households since 1940 in the United States. And some people were, say, oh, it's just because of the economic downturn of 2008 and the aftermath. But it turns out as the economy's rebounded, the proportion of older and younger living together has actually gone up. And the Pew Research Centers have been studying attitudes of older and younger people, and despite the headlines of kids versus canes, they've never seen such warmth of feeling between older and younger people. So what we're really interested in, if it runs with the grain of human nature or with maybe with the river of life. I'm fond of saying, that we rerouted the river of life and we need to return it to its natural course. And I think all over the country and really probably all over the globe, people are returning to this natural course. But the question is, you know, how do we advance and abet that? If biology flows downhill, shouldn't society? How can we reweave the social fabric in ways where these kinds of connections happen more easily in the course of daily life in ways that benefit all generations and that anticipate the 100-year life when there'll be these young people today will have already had role models for how to nurture the future when they get to this juncture themselves.
Now, I agree. And I think, you know, surely one of the greatest advantages that longevity can bring at a social level is that intergenerational mixing, because we kind of know that in some sense, 70 is the new 60 because people are fitter and healthier for longer. But of course, 70 isn't the new 60 because there's 10 year more years of experience, and bringing that back into society and into mingling seems to be a great opportunity. But in people doing these second act careers, it's obviously a big transition. I wonder what some of the challenges were that you found at an individual level or indeed a sort of a social level.
I'm so glad you raised that question, because that is the big issue that comes out not just in the surveys that we've done, but also in focus groups around the country. People are struggling with this transition from what's last to what's next. For, you know, they may aspire to have an encore career, but aspiration and action are different things. And I think so many people are finding themselves essentially in an improvisational project, even though millions and millions of people are already going through this transition and many millions more are coming on their heels. It seems like everybody's trying to figure it out one at a time. I've been struck and somewhat amused by this wave of older people in America who are sneaking into internship and fellowship programs designed for their children. Teach for America here in the U.S. I know the inspiration for things like Teach First in the UK. Am I getting that right? Is it Teach First?
Yeah,
it's in the UK. There's actually a growing number of older people who are joining Teach for America, whose kids were in the program, and they were inspired by their kids' experience. I talked to one woman in Denver whose daughter had a successful stint in the program, so she applied at age 60, and to her surprise, was accepted. Ended up in a dormitory room in Houston, Texas, in the middle of the summer in 115-degree heat, sharing a room with three 22-year-olds. But now, 7 years later, she's a teacher, and over and over again, people are just being forced to use their creativity because there's not the infrastructure to help people navigate this shift in a practical vocational way. In a deeper developmental way, because people are making a transition from a previous stage of life and an earlier identity to uncharted territory. So I think there's a great need for social innovation in transitions from the middle years to the next stage of life. And I think I really want to emphasize that last next stage of life point, because without, ending up describing a lockstep life course that we want to get away from, I do think that a new period of life is emerging between the middle years and anything resembling old age. And it's a period that Peter Laslett in the UK so beautifully described when he talked about the third age and the need for a fresh map of life. And I think we're seeing the emergence of a group of people who are akin to the adolescents that emerged a century ago, who were neither children, neither adults. We created a whole category for them. And I think the same thing is happening now for so many people here in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, and yet who lack an identity, who lack coherent social policies to help them make transitions, and who need something very different from their parents' generation.
Yeah, and that social innovation takes a terribly long while. I mean, as you know from teenagers, it was about 60 years, and you have some pioneers who experiment. Some of it get it right, some of it get it wrong. But all the the changes from the parents, the changes from business, and the changes of government take a very long while before it's fully accommodated. So, as you said, people are pioneering, but they lack a social infrastructure. Encore.org has some programs and some fellowship schemes. This presumably is trying to provide something of an infrastructure.
We are, and in a way, they grew out of the Experience Corps experience, because we discovered even early on in that effort, which is like a Peace Corps for older people focused on helping children read, that people weren't just passing through. This wasn't just a brief hiatus. Then, in fact, they stayed for a decade or longer and created a body of work. And so that raised the question of how people could more effectively transition into those types of experiences. We've seen an efflorescence of education programs in recent years, most notably Harvard's Advanced Leadership Initiative, Stanford's Distinguished Careers Institute, and a wave of other adaptations of that model, essentially one-year opportunities to go back to school. In fact, many of our community colleges in America are creating these kinds of transition programs. So school has become one vehicle. We ran a program with 40 community colleges around the country to do inexpensive, expedited educational experiences for people. And more recently, we've been doing a fellowship program. We've called it the Encore Fellowship, and it's a one-year, half-time fellowship. Pays $30,000 American, and in many cases provides health benefits, which is so important to so many people at this age in the United States. And it's essentially a chance to try before you buy. I know you've had Herminia Barra on the podcast, and it was really the program was in many ways inspired by her research showing the importance of experimentation and trying on roles as opposed to having some grand fantasy about what you want to do next. And we've had success working with a number of companies, HP, IBM, probably Intel, been the most dramatic, where they pledged a few years ago that every retirement eligible Intel employee in America who wanted to do an Encore fellowship, which places them in an NGO using skills that they honed in their midlife career but adapting them to new purposes, that every Intel retiree who wants to do that can, and the company fully funds it. So we've had close to 1,000 Intel retirees who've gone through that program. Overall, this year, there are probably about 800 Encore Fellows from a variety of backgrounds. And they're working on environmental issues and children's issues, homelessness, poverty, a whole set of pressing social concerns, but in ways that blend the old and the new. They're drawing on well-established skills, but adapting them to new settings.
Wow. And what are the biggest challenges to success of those programs and those individual transitions?
You know, it's interesting. I think a lot of the challenges we anticipated didn't materialize, which has really been an argument for launch and learn. Some of the other projects we've developed in the past, I remember years ago we had something called Life Option Centers, which sounded very very appealing when we drew it up on the whiteboard and went absolutely nowhere. And then when we started the Encore Fellows program, we thought we'd run into all sorts of barriers, including critiques of the companies participating, that the program was just a fig leaf for getting rid of less desirable employees. So none of those things have materialized. I think what's really shocked us is the receptivity of nonprofit organizations, of NGOs. We thought we'd have to grab them by the lapels and convince them to take this new source of talent. And from the very first, we did a pilot with 10 people. There were 20 organizations that lined up to compete for those people. Now we have some cities. In Portland, Oregon, this year we have 200 Encore Fellows essentially flooding the NGO sector, and I think it's had a big impact on these nonprofits and their hiring practices. They've, I remember when we did the first pilot, 9 of the 10 got job offers, fully paid market rate job offers with the organizations after their fellowship was over. I mean, I think another development that we didn't fully anticipate is how much these fellows themselves have banded together and created support groups to help each other navigate this important shift. So far the results have been enormously encouraging, and we're hoping that more and more companies will adopt this option for transitioning older employees. And I think that there are policy opportunities as well for people who aren't fortunate enough to work for benevolent organizations in their midlife career, but who themselves are eager to make a transition and to get a new round of experience on their resume.
Yeah. Now, one of the many things I like about hearing you talk, Mark, is the way that you deal with longevity. And of course, part of longevity is that people are younger for longer. But one of the things I think that you stress very strongly is that's to sort of misconceive somewhat longevity, because, of course, there is still an aging going on. And I know you're writing your next book, which I think is currently called How to Live Forever. Do you want to say a little bit about some of the themes behind that?
Absolutely. Thanks for asking about that. G. Stanley Hall, who was the founder of American Psychology, had a wonderful expression. He described this new period of life that was opening up between the middle years and old age. He described it as an Indian summer. And he said, human beings didn't reach the height of their capacities until the shadows started slanting eastward. And I thought about that. And I think he captures really a sweet spot in life that so many people, even in the context of longer lives, are experiencing, where they become increasingly aware of their own mortality. There are all those medical rituals we start going through at 50 or at 60 that remind us that life doesn't go on forever. And yet at the same time, so many of us are beneficiaries of an increasing health span. And so mortality and longevity and capacity essentially start converging, and people have a perspective on what matters most and the ability to act on that. And I think for many people, it's a realization that that we're a species that lives on. Even as our own lives stretch, we live on from generation to generation. Eric Erickson, the great psychologist, said the most important aspect of happiness in this period was generativity, which he counterposed to stagnation and said that it could be encapsulated in the phrase, I am what survives of me. And so we just see so many people moving in the direction of mentoring younger generations at work, in communities, through efforts like Experience Corps. And when you go talk to them, one of the things that comes out so strikingly is a sense of joy. And it may be think that the real fountain of youth is the fountain with youth. And rather than trying so hard to be young, we should actually focus more on being there for those who are, for our own happiness. And because as we, move into societies where there's so many more older people than younger people, it's just going to be a critical component to sustainability. And really, it's an ancient idea. You go and look at religious traditions and texts, and it's there, but how do we adapt these time-honored ideas to the modern family world, find new ways to do old things, essentially? And so at Encore, we're trying to do that through a campaign called Generation to Generation, aimed at mobilizing a million people over 50 to help the next generation thrive. And I'm trying to write a book around the idea that the real fountain of youth is the fountain with youth, and that a key to our ability to navigate the longevity revolution and these demographic changes is to create new ways to engage, new opportunities for older people to engage in the lives of young people, not just for older people today, but for all those young people who themselves, probably quicker than they think, will be at this juncture.
Yeah, no, I've always impressed with this, and I think you're right. Clearly to reap the full benefits at an individual level of longevity, we need to invest in ourselves, and we need to invest in being healthy and being fit and being happy. But I think that critical insight you have, that, as you said, the true fountain of youth is to be found in youth rather than recreating yourself youth, is spot on. And, you know, particularly in the West, with the Industrial Revolution, we developed this three-stage view of the world, a three-stage view of life that was real, led to age segregation. And unwinding that is going to be so important, both as we increase longevity and people still want purpose and to be productive, but also, I think, as you said, to really generate the welfare gains that longevity can bring. So fascinating. Very much looking forward to reading the book, Mark. And thank you for sharing some of your insights and time. I do think Encore is a fascinating organisation, and the scale of your aspiration, just that million people over 50 engaging, is just wonderful. So good luck, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Andrew. It's a great pleasure to talk to you this morning.
Thank you. Bye.